And if baseball doesn't get your heart pumping, you could check out the remake of Nightmare on Elm Street. Last weekend, it was the biggest thing at the box office.
Who are you?
Remember me?
Okay, Freddy Krueger, played in the new film by Jackie Earle Haley, scared the pants off a new generation so thoroughly that there are already plans for another one.
Since the original Nightmare on Elm Street was released in 1984, there's been another huge technological change in horror films. Cell phones. If teens in peril can just pull out their phones and call for help, the scary movie isn't quite so scary, is it? For member station KPBS, Beth Accomando reports.
There's no such thing as a reliable network for cell phone service in horror movies. Take the upcoming film, The Human Centipede. Two young women get stranded and are held captive by a mad surgeon.
There's no signal. What? There's no signal. There's always a signal.
Actually, there's not. Just look what happens to the family in the remake of The Hills Have Eyes. They discover that no matter how far technology advances, no signal is just the first of four basic limitations in the horror film provider package.
Find a signal?
No, nothing. 97% nationwide coverage and we find ourselves in that 3%.
Which brings us to the second plan limitation, cell phone battery life. It's even shorter than your life in a horror film, especially when you've got chatty friends like in The Roost.
Did you try your cell phone again?
Yeah, it's dead. You used up all the battery and you're talking to Mike.
The third issue is more user error, as in, whoops, I dropped the phone in the toilet, pool, sink, or like in Disturbia.
I dropped my phone in his car!
And finally, the killer himself can disrupt your service plan by destroying your phone or politely knocking it into the sink, as Michael Pitt does before terrorizing Naomi Watts in Funny Games.
Oh, God.
What? Oh, no!
I'm sorry.
But these genre cliches divide fans in San Diego's horror and action meetup group. Just ask Wayne Sherman and Dante Moran.
Oh, I don't have service. You had service when you were driving there, but as soon as the 6'9" mass killer with an axe comes out, cell phone doesn't work, the battery's dying, blah, 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 blah. And of course, there's no charger.
Some of the cliches make it a horror film. Right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it puts you in the right state of mind and so forth. But sort of you signed up for some of those things.
But maybe horror movies need to check out the service plan over at the end of the world Armageddon apocalypse genre. After all, cell phone service was quite robust in 2012. Everyone had service in that movie. Even the guy atop a mountain peak about to be wiped out by a tsunami could call his friend to say goodbye.
Sanem, where are you?
On the Nampan Plateau.
What?
Tidal wave coming from the east. It's gigantic.
That tidal wave is about to wipe out all of India, but there's still cell service. Now, if we can just find out who his provider is, maybe we can save those kids on Elm Street from a new Freddy Krueger. For NPR News, I'm Beth Accomando.
And you can see all the ways filmmakers kill off cell phones in a video montage at our website, npr.org.
You know, we always have service at Morning Edition. You can find us all day on Twitter, at Morning Edition and at NPR Inskeep. That's me.
We're also at facebook.com/NPR Morning Edition. And this is, of course, Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
And now, another view of life in New Orleans. Some of you may have been glued to your television sets last night for the latest installment in the critically acclaimed series Tremé. The HBO drama has already garnered critical acclaim and counts President Barack Obama among its fans. In Tremé, the characters are as big as the music they love, and everybody is trying to navigate life in a post-Katrina New Orleans. The series begins 3 months after the hurricane, when many in New Orleans began to greet each other in a new way.
Hey, how's your house?
Oh, no.
How's your house?
We're up on Octavia. How about you?
Still living on the boat.
Y'all got a lot of water?
See the line over my head.
I can't stay here, Dad.
Wait.
Yes!
I'm this close to getting a new water heater. Do you think you could float me along?
Oh.
I'm a musician. What do you want me to say?
You're a disc jockey.
Few know these corners of New Orleans as well as Lola's Eric Eli. He's a writer for Treme, a former columnist for the Times-Picayune, and also co-producer of a documentary on the New Orleans neighborhood from which Treme takes his name. And he's joining us now from his home office in New Orleans to give us an update on how things are going. Welcome to you. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Michelle. Thanks for asking.
Well, can I just get your sense of things in the wake of this? Well, Bob Marshall just told us it's not a spill. It's a river of oil. Can I just ask how you're reacting to all this?
It's a shock in that so much is going well this year. I mean, between the Saints and the announcement of the show, and it's doing well. The impression was that we might have been leaving our worst fears behind. But this brings to mind many of the disaster worst-case scenarios that we feared after the federal levee failure.
Is it bringing up some bad memories for you?
Yeah.
And not just you, I assume.
Well, at the time when Hurricane Katrina hit, I was a columnist for the Times-Picayune, and one of the things I wrote about was the impact on fisheries. And there's a lot about the federal policy that made it difficult to get aid to fishermen. And that is not only our livelihood financially, it's also our culture.
I want to mention that today is a big day in the life of New Orleans, nearly 5 years after Katrina struck the coast. Today is also the last day that New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin serves. A new mayor is taking over. How is all that playing together? You've got, on the one hand, new leadership coming in who was elected with wide-ranging support. And I don't know, how is all that working together?
Well, Mitch Landrieu's election as mayor is another part of the optimism here, the sense that we can turn a new page in the book. And so it's just a great juxtaposition to have those two different elements happening simultaneously. The last couple of years of the Nagin administration have been particularly troubling in that it seemed to many people that the mayor had been beaten down by all that he'd gone through and was neither particularly effective nor particularly interested in the job. So Mitch Landrieu brings a new energy to the office, but this reminds us, this oil spill reminds us that some of the old problems still remain.
So let's talk a bit about Treme. Why did you want to be involved in this, in the series, and how did you come to be involved in it?
Well, I had met David Simon during the last season of The Wire because my high school classmate, Wendell Pierce, lived next door. At that point, we threw a joint carnival party, so all the guys from The Wire were down here. We met then, and he called me a couple of times subsequent to that. And although I had not initially thought about going into television writing, the opportunity to tell our story to the HBO audience, and perhaps more importantly, to humanize these issues that everyone in America has heard about, but relatively few of us have any real sense of, that was a great opportunity. And most of the time what you hear from the politicians and from the Chamber of Commerce is about all the economic stuff. You should come down here and build your plant and so forth. But that's not really what we're good at. And these people are interested in what we're good at and who we are.
You know, the series doesn't pull any punches about some of the things that, how can we put this, that many people find kind of crazy making about New Orleans. Like there's a line in last night's episode, an exchange where the character of Sonny, the musician, tells somebody a line to the effect of, I traveled all the way from Amsterdam to New Orleans and you couldn't drive 5 hours.
A lot of what Sonny is talking about is the fascination that the world has with New Orleans. But part of what's been problematic for us is the things that New Orleans is so great at. We're talking about food, music, architecture, culture, a sense of a regional culture, even in the midst of all this American culture. Those things are not really valued nationally. Most people around the country wonder whether or not they're going to get a new Walmart or a new McDonald's. We're more worried about whether or not the old traditions of po' boys and of our local grocery stores, et cetera, will remain.
Do you feel that the series is in part a way to help the country understand what it is that they should value and love as much as you do?
It really is, because part of what was problematic about getting our story out immediately after Hurricane Katrina was the politics of it were so complicated. Because George Bush took so long to get here initially, any criticism of government reaction was really going to be focused on him. But in fact, our main problem was not his fault. Our main problem was the failure of the Army Corps of Engineers over several decades to build decent levees. And neither George Bush nor Barack Obama now seems to really understand the magnitude of that crisis. Everyone talks about what Hurricane Katrina did to New Orleans. Hurricane Katrina did not do that much to New Orleans. It did tremendous damage to the Gulf Coast of Mississippi. What Hurricane Katrina did was overtop and breach levees that were supposed to be able to withstand it. That's what John Goodman's rant about is in the first episode. It's like, wait a minute, this is what actually happened here. And more important, when you look at flooding in other places, now we're talking about flooding in Tennessee today, these are also Army Corps of Engineer projects that need to be examined, need to be subject to further scrutiny. That's the lesson of New Orleans.
Well, it obviously, one doesn't want to overstate the impact that any one television show, book, series, whatever, can have on that kind of ingrained point of view. But having said that, do you have any sense of how you will know if your point of view and the point of view of others who are shared there is getting headway, or whether people are starting to see it the way you see it?
Well, I tell you, we have messages that we would like to convey, but fundamentally, this has to be good television and good storytelling. And if people enjoy the show on whatever level they enjoy it, we'll be happy and we'll feel ourselves to be successful. There was a public school here that had been a predominantly black public school that now is a charter school and predominantly white. We got a brief line about that situation in one of our episodes. A lot of local people caught it. The national audience probably didn't and shouldn't have. It was not something that they needed to understand. But in that sense, if the national audience can enjoy the show and be interested in what happens to our characters, we'll be successful.
Finally, just want to read a line from David Simon, as you mentioned, one of the co-creators of Treme, wrote an open letter to the people of New Orleans that appeared in the Times-Picayune, where he talked about kind of the balance between good drama and being sort of journalistically accurate. And he wrote, "Your sensibilities matter to us because we have tried to be honest with that extraordinary time, not journalistically true, but thematically so. We have depicted certain things that happened and others that didn't happen, and then still others that didn't happen, but truly should have happened. This is a nice way of saying we have lied." I'm sorry, I just wanted to read that because I thought it was funny. So, any final thought for us? And good luck to you with all that's going on down there.
Well, I appreciate your calling. John Logsdon and I did a documentary about this neighborhood called Faubourg Treme, which is a big part of my education in the neighborhood and understanding its importance to the country. So that was really a big part of my understanding. And I'm happy that we're now getting the kind of attention that we deserve for this part of the country.
All right. Lois Eric Eli is a writer for the HBO series Treme. He's also co-producer and co-director, as he just told you, of the documentary Faubourg Treme, The Untold Story of Black New Orleans. And he joined us from his home office in Treme. And I thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
When Conan O'Brien left The Tonight Show, he was contractually banned from television. That ban ended this weekend with an interview on CBS's 60 Minutes. In it, O'Brien talked about his forced departure from NBC.
If I had surrendered The Tonight Show and handed it over to somebody publicly and wished them well, I would not have come back 6 months later. But that's me. Everyone's got their own way of doing things.
As NPR entertainment blogger Linda Holmes explains, O'Brien is sticking to a strategy that's working.
Conan O'Brien's contractual veil of silence was lifted Saturday, and his Sunday night appearance on 60 Minutes continued one of television's most remarkable lemons to lemonade stories. For a guy who lost The Tonight Show 7 months after he got it, O'Brien has done just fine. He got a lot of money from NBC when he left. He got boatloads of public sympathy. He's touring live and being greeted like Captain Sully landing on the Hudson. And in the fall, he'll be a highly paid host again on TBS. The obvious question, how do you leave with a payout worth tens of millions of dollars, land a new show right away, and still be an underdog folk hero to many of your fans? For one thing, O'Brien gets sympathy by not asking for it. He insisted Sunday that he wasn't mistreated, as fans often tell him he was. "I'm fine," he told Steve Croft. "It just didn't work out." For another, he balances rejecting victimhood with admitting that it hurts to lose your dream job, no matter how much money you take with you. Million-dollar payouts may not be very relatable to fans, but a toxic work environment, which is what he called it, where you feel unwelcome, that can happen to anybody. O'Brien's smartest choice, though, is holding back, but just barely, about Jay Leno. He declined to answer a question about whether Leno had behaved honorably, but he did say that taking back the show so soon wasn't what he would have done. And he laughed out loud when reminded that Leno sees himself and O'Brien as similarly situated victims of network misdeeds, pointing out that Leno has the show they both wanted while he has his unemployment beard and a life on the road. O'Brien managed to sound self-deprecating while eviscerating Leno's argument. Whether he means to or not, the guy has played the public relations game magnificently from the beginning, right from the moment he addressed his statement giving up The Tonight Show to people of Earth. He's been funny, but he's also sad. And when he temporarily lost television as an outlet, he packed his guitar and hit the road. On his very last Tonight Show, O'Brien begged his fans not to become cynical. He told them, nobody in life gets exactly what they thought they were going to get, but if you work really hard and you're kind, amazing things will happen. Since then, he's explored Twitter, met his public in person, and defied expectations by jumping to cable. He sings about being fired, he grows out that beard, and he insists that he's all right. It just didn't work out. It would be cynical to see his rejection of cynicism and self-pity as a public relations gambit, but if they were one, he could hardly have hoped it would go any better.
Linda Holmes is NPR's pop culture blogger. You can watch Conan O'Brien's entire 60 Minutes interview at NPR's arts and entertainment blog, Monkey See, at npr.org.
You're listening to NPR.
And on to a different kind of education story. We found it in the pages of the Washington Post magazine, which we dig into just about every week to find interesting stories about the way we live now. In this case, it's about the way we dance now. Now, if you'd like to get your groove on, you're not alone. Sarah Wildman recently learned how to move her body to the sounds of J Dilla and Flying Lotus and other hip-hop tracks at the Urban Dance Institute of Washington here in the nation's capital. She wrote about taking a hip-hop class in this week's magazine, Fitness Edition, and she joins us now to tell us more. Welcome. Thanks for joining us, or welcome back, I should say.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So you write that you've always danced in any city you've ever lived in, and that there have been a number of them, but you've never taken a hip-hop class. So what made you decide to do that now?
I'd always wanted to take a hip-hop class, but maybe I was a little bit afraid to, that I wouldn't do it as well, or that I needed to know something I didn't know, I didn't have the right gear. And I thought, given that I was coming back to dance after a year away, I had a baby last year, that, you know, it was a good time as any to start.
Now, when you say you were nervous, I think we should kind of cut to the chase. Is it part of, you know, kind of stranger in a strange land kind of thing? Because hip-hop is identified as kind of an African-American art form, even though hip-hop is worldwide now. But was that part of it? Because you're white, you thought, oh, maybe I won't fit in?
I don't know if it was that. I mean, maybe a little bit, I guess, if I'm completely honest. In fact, when I met Junius Brickhouse, who is the founder of Urban Artistry, the company that runs the classes I took
at the incredibly aptly named Junius Brickhouse.
Yes. I said to him, you might remember me. I'm the white girl that introduced herself to you at class today. Yeah, I was definitely aware of it. And I was aware that there was a certain street sense that I didn't know if I had. But coming into these classes, all that dropped away. There was an incredible welcoming overture from pretty much everybody I encountered.
But, you know, I do think we should talk a little bit about the fact that you say in the piece that some dance and exercise classes, no matter who's running them, take on this high schoolish kind of mean girls aura. You call it the familiar mean girl swagger from some of the class regulars. I mean, anybody who's ever taken a dance class will know what I'm talking about. There's just like, that's my spot.
Right. Don't block the mirror, please.
Don't block the mirror, please. This is my spot.
And there's the banter with the teacher. They all know each other. Often someone's sleeping with the teacher. You know, there's something with that.
Oh, I didn't know about that part. Sorry, I missed that part. But then when you add the racial dynamic to that, I do wonder, do you think that other people might, I'll just be honest, I mean, minorities by definition are used to being in the minority. But for somebody who's white, who isn't used to being in the minority, do you think that that's, you know, part of the hesitation of embracing the form?
Well, it's interesting because hip-hop is now taught pretty much everywhere. I mean, it's taught at Washington Sports Club. It's taught at Drive Motion, which is a more, let's just say, it's a whiter dance class. And so it's become normalized or commercialized. It's become across the board. And I actually thought it would be more interesting and more true and more authentic to take it in the community and not sort of take that step back. you know, to sort of say, this is where it's coming from. And if I want to learn it, I want to go to the roots and I want to really understand it. And if I feel uncomfortable, well, you know, that's good. Maybe occasionally white people, because we always have that sort of privilege on the street, maybe I should, you know, take that discomfort and, you know, embrace it.
But it turns out that concern was, however present or implicit it was, really wasn't there at all. You actually really had a good time.
I had a great time. I thought the women were incredibly welcoming. And as you said, sometimes it's clicky. This wasn't clicky at all. I mean, in every break, somebody extended a hand to me and said, you're new. And I said, I'm not good. And they said, no, it doesn't matter. You know, if you're into it, if you want to groove and you're here, then great. Join in. You'll pick it up.
What did you like about it? And particularly as a person who has experienced and enjoyed many different forms of dance, including classical dance and modern, and has in fact studied all, taken classes all over the world. What did you like about it?
Well, first of all, I mean, it is like you're in the club, right? I mean, it's what you listen to when you go out. And so inherently, your body's already moving. You walk in and you hear that beat and you just want to move. So maybe you can't pop and lock and do New Jack Swing exactly right, but you're already kind of feeling the music in your body. And there's a little, while there's precision to it, and definitely there's technique to it, and they're teaching something, you also have a little fluidity with how you interpret the movement in a way you don't, for example, in a ballet class.
So any tips for somebody who's thinking about taking the plunge and still a little nervous?
My biggest worry for anyone, which was mine too, is your cardio level. I mean, it was hard. I was in full sweat. I realized, oh my God, I thought that, you know, yoga had kept me in shape. Not in shape like this. They are in amazing shape. I mean, this is like America's Best Dance Crew. I mean, they are moving and they look incredible and it's fun, but you got to go in there knowing you're going to sweat.
Okay, I think we should drop a little Jay Dilla so we can see some moves. You gonna bust a move for us? I want to check. I want to see, like, Sarah Wildman, bust a move. What's your signature move? Come on, show me something.
I think I can do. I can kind of do a roll pretty well.
Okay, Missy, yeah. She's got it going on. Okay.
I've taken African-based jazz classes also, too. I mean, this is just different because this is more street.
And she's doing the role.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Sarah Wildman is a freelance writer and contributor to the Washington Post magazine. We'll have a link to her story if you want to read it in its entirety, and we hope you will. Just visit the Tell Me More page at npr.org. Sarah, thank you.
Thanks for having me.